This little ditty is Stars Fall on Alabama by Billie Holiday, which was a song written about the great star shower of 1833, which is what I'm going to be talking about here today. It looks like we're going to get a break in the weather, so I put something in at the end regarding some of the treats that we'll see tonight in the sky. Can everybody see that okay? Is the focus okay?
Yep.
Great. My name's John Horrigan. I'm not a member, per se, of the South Shore Astronomy Society, but I'm a historical astronomer. I love the history of astronomy from the 16th through the 19th century, a weather historian and a historical fire researcher. And I'm an old New England folklorist, a pocket historian. I've been called some things that I can't print here. I don't have a prefix before my name or a suffix after my name, nor do I have $150,000 in student loans chasing me. So I'm just what you call an old New England folklorist. Cell phones off, please. Usually when I say that, mine rings. There's always somebody in the audience that knows more about the subject than I do, and of course, somebody who thinks that they know about the subject. We're going to talk about meteor showers and the night that the stars fell. The night the stars fell is, according to Richard Devins in his Our First Century, describing the night of November 12th through 13th, 1833, he said, "The most grand and brilliant celestial phenomenon ever beheld and recorded by man." A man by the name of Dennison Olmsted was a professor of mathematics and philosophy at Yale. Well, he was awakened by his neighbor at 5:15 a.m. on November 13, 1833, and he saw the meteors radiating from the constellation Leo. So he wrote to the New Haven Daily Herald after that, and somehow he became the clearinghouse for information and interpretation of the night the stars fell. He became the star of the night the stars fell, and it changed his life. He was the one to first theorize that meteor showers occurred annually, that they came from a radiant, that's an area in the sky, and were associated with the Earth passing through dust clouds, which were later attributed to comets. He was the first to associate aurora borealis with solar activity as well. Boston Transcript said this on November 13, 1833. "Meteor succeeded meteor in such rapid succession that it was impossible to count them. At times the sky seemed full of them, and the earth was illuminated as with a morning light. Those who were so fortunate as to witness the scene describe it as brilliant beyond conception." This is a lost depiction that I found in the Boston Transcript at the Mass Historical Society. It's very primitive, but it showed up on November 16, 1833 in the Boston Transcript. Alexandria Gazette, November 14, 1833, quote, "A more magnificent and splendid spectacle was never presented." It was also printed in the Richmond Inquirer of November 19th of 1833. A letter by Thomas Kenny on November 14th, 1833 to Baltimore American and then published in the Richmond Inquirer on November 19th said, "It seemed to rain fire." Charleston Mercury, "Those who were up before the dawn yesterday witnessed a most glorious sight, one glance at which were worth 10 years of common life. This was the most spectacular astronomical event in recorded history." Natchez, Mississippi Courier, quote, "From 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock, this is in the morning, the scene was truly magnificent. Thousands upon thousands of meteors were darting about in all directions without having an instant cessation. It was so light that upon the first awakening, many thought that the city was on fire." New York Commercial Advertiser, "A correspondent of the Philadelphia National Gazette estimates their number at 2,160 in the compass of 2 hours and a half. More than that number were visible here within every 10 minutes of that period, and it was difficult to count them as to the number of raindrops." Salt River Journal in Bowling Green, Missouri, still a primitive area in the West. "The most perfect master of language would fail of conveying to others a full picture of this extraordinary and uncommon appearance." I substituted some names here. I replaced the name Slave. Hartford Times, December 2nd, 1833. "The plantation workers in the South who saw the phenomenon describe it as snowing fire. They generally thought that the day of judgment has come." And from the Charleston Mercury, and again, I make some word substitutions here. "I was suddenly awakened by the most distressing cries that ever fell on my ears. Shrieks of horror and cries for mercy I could hear from most of the laborers of three plantations, amounting in all to about 600 or 800. While earnestly listening for the cause, I heard a faint voice near the door calling my name. At this moment, I heard the same voice saying, 'Oh my God, the world is on fire.' I then opened the door, and it's difficult to say the awfulness of the scene. Upwards of 100 plantation laborers lay prostrate on the ground, some speechless and some with the bitterest cries, but most with their hands raised, imploring God to save the world with them. So these slaves thought that the world was about to end. Reverend Hector Humphreys, president of St. John's College at Annapolis. His wife Marie yelled fire as the room became bright and was lit from outside, a shower of sparks. They all appeared to come from a common center at or near the zenith. That's overhead of the sky. Many awoke thinking their dwellings were afire. There was almost an infinite amount of meteors. They fell like flakes of snow. It was a perfectly silent and simultaneous dance of the stars. Judge James Flanagan, Clark County, Kentucky, quote, "The people were struck with awe and thrown into great consternation, and one of the effects of the remarkable occurrence was to awaken a pious feeling, causing a general religious revival throughout Christendom. It scared everybody to prayers." An observer of the star rain in Fredericksburg, Virginia, predicted that the Civil War would come after seeing it. So this preceded the Civil War by some 30 years. The whole starry host of heaven seemed to be in a state of practical secession and revolt, which parallels only in the affairs of Earth. And then the meteor jokers of Clark County, Kentucky, my name. Thomas F. Donaldson and M. Fritzy went into church with the congregation to pray for mercy. Well, they took a tin bugle and climbed up a ladder to the top of the church rafters and positioned themselves. Just as the preacher said, "Be ready because Gabriel's trumpet might sound at any moment," Donaldson blew a loud and shrill bugle blast. Fritz then yelled from the rafters in an authoritative voice, "I am Gabriel. The world has ended. I summon all nations to arise and come to judgment." Well, all the people knelt down and prayed, refusing to leave the church. When they left the next morning, timidly peering outside the church door, Donaldson and Fritz were long gone. Here's the depiction of the night the stars fell in 1833 over Niagara Falls. And again, I've looked at so many of these lithographs, these woodcuts, and I want to look for exaggeration, but all of them have as if it's a fireworks display. This is the famous woodcut rendered by a witness of the great star shower. "They came down like embers. The stars of heaven fell unto earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind." Sparks and tongues of fire. Now, this is pretty cool. These are pictographs of the night the stars fell, November 1833, as depicted by the Sioux Native American tribe. And I've always found this very, very interesting. So, just talking about meteors and meteor showers, we're making good time here, Paul. We're making good time here, George. George, keep me honest to the clock, okay? 10 up. Well, the Earth's rotation is 1,000 miles per hour. The revolution around the sun is 67,000 miles per hour. So, what is this? Well, the Earth travels through the dust tails of comets, and that's what causes a meteor shower, as you can see them banging off of the Earth's atmosphere. They burn up as they enter. They're just dust particles. Oh, did we? Okay. All right.
Play with the plug a little bit.
Pull the plug a little?
There you go.
Okay, let's try it again. Let's try it again here. Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. Huh? For some reason, it's not going to take my animation, I think. Okay. Let me see if I can get beyond that. I'm sorry about that, folks. Basically, that shows the Earth going through a dust cloud. Okay, we're losing it. Do you want to cut over to my projector? Or I'm in.
Hang on.
Oh, there we go. Okay. There we go. Look at that. Persistence. So again, the Earth travels. I think it's the animation, because that you had. If you could just adjust it one more time, and I'll buzz through the animation.
Yep.
Okay. Meteor showers. Well, okay.
Is it called Bill Gates?
Yeah. The most famous are the Leonids and the Perseids. Leonids taking place in November, which is when the night the stars fell, and the Perseids, which are the spectacular meteor showers in August. And going on in May, in early May, are the Aquarids. In fact, they're just beginning tonight. Some Perseid factoids. It's the remnants of a comet, Comet Swift Tuttle. It's called the Tears of St. Lawrence because St. Lawrence was a martyr who was grilled to death, tasty, while trying to protect the Holy Grail. The Perseid meteor shower has been observed for about 2,000 years, with the first known information on these meteors coming from the Far East. The peak is about 60 per hour, and that's St. Lawrence and his grill. Some great Perseid meteor showers was the Fusillade from Heaven of 1839, the Great Star Fall of 1863, the Great Leonid Meteor Showers of 1799, 1833, 1866, and even 1966. Some great meteor showers of antiquity that I've dug out, the solar eclipse and meteor impact of India, that took place at 287 before the Common Era. Yale professor Hubert A. Newton identifies historical records of meteor displays, 11 previous outbursts, 585 AD, 902 AD in the Mediterranean, 931 and 934 in China, year 10,002 in Japan, 1202 in Egypt, 1366 in Europe, 1582, 1602 in the Far East, and 1698 in Japan. Some notable meteor showers of the 18th century, the meteor of 1787, Humboldt and Bonpland's Mexico Rain of Fire, which took place in November of 1799, and there's a depiction to the right. The Great Star Shower, as it's called, of 1799. The Great Leonid Shower, as seen by missionaries in Greenland. I think this is a pretty neat depiction here with the icebergs. Back when there was ice, of course, in Greenland. Notable meteor showers of the 19th century. The Lyrid Outbursts of 1803. The Balls of Fire and Stone Shower of April 26, 1803, which had a huge fall of meteorites at Lyell. The meteorite of 1807, the meteor shower of 1844, the meteor shower and comet of 1862, number 3 of August 10th, 1862, Alexander Herschel's spectroscopic analysis of the meteor showers of August 10th and November 14th, 1865, the Hungarian meteor rain of June 9th, 1866, the grand meteor shower of November 1866, those Leonids, and I'm going to have a comment on that in a moment. And please bear with me, I'm hustling through this, everybody, so before we get tossed. Some other one, the Sconset Meteor of June 1st, 1868. That's harkening back to Nantucket. And then we have the Beelid Meteor Shower of 1872. Basically, H.A. Newton, all of his texts, he basically was the one that determined that the Leonid period was 33 and a quarter years, and he predicted the next return would actually occur on November of 1866. He was right. It was very important in the annals of astronomy because he actually predicted the return of a meteor shower. But unfortunately, like the Hurricane Center that predicts these hurricanes every year that never come, the Leonid's failure of 1899 proved to be, according to C.P. Olivier, the worst blow ever suffered by astronomy in the eyes of the public, because they had predicted that it would be a spectacular meteor shower in that time, and it was not. Some notable meteor showers of the 20th century, the Lyrid Outbursts of 1922, the Giacobini-Zinner meteor shower of October 1933, and, of course, the Great Leonid Meteor Shower of 1966. That was a spectacular meteor shower. I think everybody's way too young in here to be around in 1966. Paul, you must have been 4 then, right?
No, I was a little...
Yeah, but do you remember that, Paul? Do you have any recollections of that?
I remember that.
Okay. 21st century meteor showers. We all remember the Great Leonid Shower of November 18th, 2001. Anybody here from the Society get a chance to go into that? And any recollections? There's been some... I called the piezoelectric fires of Messina, Italy, a sky shower in February of 2004. There was a rare meteor shower in September of 2007 called the Alpha Aurigids. And this shower has only been seen 3 times before, in 1935, 1986, and 1994. And it's associated with a comet that takes 2,000 years to orbit the sun. On December 22nd, 2000, a rare and vivid display of the Ursid meteors took place when the Earth hit a dense trail of dust created by a comet from the year 1405. Then there was the bizarre Peruvian meteorite of September 15, 2007. I don't know if you heard about this, that made people violently ill if they went around it. It left a crater in the dirt, and people apparently got sick. And then there was a tremendous Finnish bolide a couple of weeks later in September of 2007. And just some stories here about getting hit by a meteor. I always have a child asked me about that. Well, on November 12, 2007, in Cedar Key, Florida, a fourth grader got a personal hands-on lesson in meteorites. Jeremiah Barnes, age 10, saw a meteorite fall into his yard. After seeing an object streak into the yard, Jeremiah thought one of his cousins had thrown something over the fence. After running over to the object and touching it, Jeremiah said he knew it was something extraordinary. "It burned my finger, so I ran in the house and got my sister," Jeremiah said. After seeing a blister rise on her brother's index finger, Angel Niece, a 14-year-old ninth grader, doused the object with water from the garden hose. Brother and sister watched in fascination as the water being poured into the shoebox-sized hole made the object instantly begin boiling. Another one. It was nearly dusk on the evening of August 31st, 1991, in the small town of Noblesville, Indiana. Two boys, 13-year-old Brody Spaulding and 9-year-old Brian Kinsey, had just finished riding bikes and were standing talking on Brody's lawn. Suddenly, they heard a low-pitched whistling sound, and Brian saw an object spinning through the air past Brody. The object, which looked like a rock, landed with a thud on the ground near them. Well, the boys picked up the rock and found it slightly warm. They looked around but couldn't find anyone who might have thrown it. "That thing hit me." August 22, 2002, England. Chauvin Cowton, 14, was getting into the family car outside her North Allerton home at 10:30 when a stone fell on her from the sky. She had a deep bruise on her shoulder. And finally, Park Forest Intruder. March 26, 2003, Park Forest, Illinois. Some people who were in their living rooms watching war coverage thought that the United States was under attack with the amazing light show produced by the meteors. It started with a blast of light and a thunderous sound. Then, chunks of meteorites dropped from the sky. One of the larger segments fell through the roof of a family home and into the bedroom where a young boy was sleeping. Then all of a sudden, a big rock came down right through that hole there, Noe Garza said, pointing to the hole through which one could see the branches of a nearby tree. "It happened too quick. I didn't know what to think, and now I'm thinking afterwards, you know. Wow." The force of the meteor not only ripped through the roof and ceiling of the house, but it shattered the window, ricocheted off the windowsill, and struck the mirrored closet door on the other side of the room. "I don't think anyone's going to believe me," said the man's son, explaining why he was bringing a small bag of fragments to school with him. Roberta Garza laughed as she showed Vedas where a meteor had gone through the plate glass of her home. "It's kind of exciting, I guess," she said. "Where's my insurance agent?" quipped her husband nearby. Now here's a fireball or a bolide rivals or exceeds the magnitude of the planet Venus, which is in between the magnitude of a -4 or a -5. This is a fireball seen on September 1st, 2005. The following day, a fireball is seen. September 2nd. Oh, do we just lose it again?
It doesn't want any animations for some reason.
No. Well, there we go. Another one. And then I want you to listen to the sound of this bolide here. I'm going to play it through.
Hang on, we lost it.
Okay. Let me just... okay, let's see if I can bring it up. Ready? Okay, we'll do that again.
Well, it's
basically a sonic boom. And here's a Super Bowl. We don't have this one either, huh? That's too bad. There we go. Here it is again. Ready? Oh, great. Good hold there. Okay. That was March of 2005. A lot of bolides in both March and September of 2005. It's just a shooting star. Now, sonic booms. Okay, the sounds of meteors. The sonic boom, I'm going to play of space shuttle mission STS-116 over Texas. Hopefully you can hear it. Here goes. This is just a sound here. Ready? Hear it? Explosion there? I'll do it one more time for you. That's what a sonic boom sounds like. That's a space shuttle re-entering. So, that's, bolides are known, my point is bolides are known to make a noise as such. Just some other sonic boom. What's a sonic boom? When an object passes through the air, it creates a series of pressure waves in front of it and behind it, similar to the bow and stern waves created by a boat. These waves travel at the speed of sound, and as the speed of the object increases, the waves are forced together or compressed because they cannot get out of the way of each other. They eventually merge into a single shock wave at the speed of sound. This critical speed is known as Mach 1 and is approximately 761 miles per hour at sea level. Now, the echo of a meteor. This is the echo of a meteor. The echoes result from reflected radio waves which bounce off the trails of fast-moving meteoroids. Each time a Geminid meteor blazes across the sky, the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama records an echo at its listening station. So let's hear that. This is a Geminid echo. Here we go. Time, and that's that. Okay. And we're in the home stretch here, folks. Radiance of meteor showers, what are they? They're tracing the tracks of meteors in a shower backwards. They appear to come from a common origin known as the radiant, the common direction of motion through space. Now, meteoroid orbits, they contribute to a meteor shower and their debris particles orbiting in the path of a comet. They spread out all along the orbit of the comet, and the comet may still exist or have been destroyed. Now, only a few sporadic meteors are not associated with comets. Of course, meteorite impacts on Earth. There are over 150 impact craters found on Earth. Barringer Crater, Meteor Crater, Flagstaff, Arizona. I've been there. Anybody else?
Spectacular. He's not here right now, but Lewis okay. has been there.
50,000 years ago, Mr. Galileo. By the way, how to give Pope Urban the business there? Stand up to him. impact craters on Earth. Much larger impact features exist on Earth. About 65 million years ago, they think that's when the Yucatan smack happened. That, come on in. We're just wrapping in. My name's John. We're just talking about meteor showers here in craters. Basically, they have a drastic influence on climate on Earth. And at this point, I just want to mention, on March 2nd, 2009, 2 months ago today, asteroid near-Earth object DD45, 2009 DD45, passed within a fifth of a lunar unit. I'm going to say that again. In other words, the distance from Earth to the moon, it was a fifth of that. That's what I call a cosmic brushback pitch. Just missed it. And of course, we saw it on the way out. So you know about the movies that we've seen about Ellie's the elimination of life events. This thing they think was about the size of the Tunguska crater that hit into the Siberian forest in the early 19th century. You saw the meteorite display here. Who's the gentleman that had the meteorite display?
Ralph.
And most meteorites are small and do not produce significant craters. You been to Antarctica yet, Ralph?
Where?
Antarctica?
No.
Bring extra mittens. All right. So you distinguish between falls, where meteorites have been observed to fall in the fall time known, and finds with meteorites with an unknown fall time. All types of meteorites, we have iron meteorites, stony iron meteorites, carbonaceous chondrite, and cut, polished, and etched with acid iron meteorites show a Widmerstadt pattern. Three broad categories: iron meteorites, stony iron meteorites. So what does one look like? Basically, iron meteorites are easy to recognize as meteorites. They're heavy, dense lumps of iron, nickel, steel. Meteoroid, and the difference between meteoroids, meteorites, and meteors. Meteoroid is a small, solid body moving within the solar system. A meteorite is solid remains of a meteor that falls to Earth. And a meteor is a bright trail of light created by small solid particles entering the Earth's atmosphere and then burning up. On any given night, just a couple of these factoids, you can see one meteor every 15 minutes. The typical size of a meteor that produces a visible streak of light ranges from about the size of a grain of sand to the size of a small pebble. And fireballs are large, brilliant meteors, sometimes called bolides, and bolides usually explode with a thunderous sound. So why do meteors have a streak of light? Well, as they travel through our atmosphere, they collide with air molecules that knock away materials and strip electrons from the meteor. When the stripped atoms recapture electrons, light's emitted. And the color of the light depends on the temperature and the material being excited. This is the Allende meteorite, which is a carbonaceous chondrite, fell in 1969 in Mexico. It showered an area about 50 kilometers by 10 kilometers with over 4 tons of fragments. It contains calcium, aluminum, and rich inclusions. Some other impacts, we were talking about the Yucatan Peninsula, the Chicxulub crater. That's where they think is the crater that ended dinosaur life on Earth about 65 million years ago. Here are some tremendous bolides from the Leonid meteor shower, November of 2001. So are all meteors the same color? Well, the material or element that makes up a meteor is the main factor that determines the color of its glowing tail. So when you see orange-yellow, you're seeing sodium. Yellow, iron. Blue-green, magnesium. Violet, calcium. And of course, red is silicon, very rare. And sporadic meteors are some that can only be seen on any given night, and they're not associated with any particular meteor shower. They come from random directions in the sky. So we've gone over what meteor showers are. Meteor trains, these are meteors that leave debris in the sky and leave actually contrail. Of course, there are bright daytime meteors, which are large particle meteors. And meteor showers are usually named for the constellation in which they're radiant, that's where they originate from, lies at the peak of the shower. So the Perseids are from Perseus, the Leonids are from Leo, the Aquarids that we're in right now are from Aquarius, and the Geminids are from Gemini. And just as I mentioned, just a variety of different meteor showers here. Historically, the Perseids in August and the Leonids in November have been the most impressive meteor showers. So true or false, play along with me here. The material or element that makes up a meteor is the main factor that determines the color of the glowing trail left behind.
True.
True. Circle gets the square. This major meteor shower has a peak time around early or mid-August. D, Perseids. What is the point in the sky from which all of the meteors seem to come during a shower call? Got it. All right. The Tunguska event, and we're wrapping it up here, is an area of destruction larger than metropolitan Washington, D.C., that hit the tundra, and I guess the tiger of Tunguska, Siberia, which is in the northeastern part of the former Soviet Union, and it just snapped trees like matchsticks. It happened in 1908. And it's the explosion of a large object. Some think it's an Apollo asteroid, 90 to 190 meters in diameter, approximately the size of that DD45 2009 asteroid that just passed by us. And the energy release was comparable to a 12 megaton nuclear weapon. That was very impressive in size 60 years ago today. That's just a pop. But this basically is a graph. I'm not going to get into it. A big meteorite impacts according to the hour and their size. So as you see, as you move along the graph to the lower right-hand corner, the larger ones are much, much rarer. If you look at the graph, the large ones, 100 kilometers or more that hit the Earth, either happened once in the Earth's history or once every 100 million years. What's magnitude? You're going to hear about that tonight if you're hanging out for the Sky Watch from 7 to 9 p.m. that the Society's putting on. It's the brightness of a celestial object. The Sun is a negative 26.7. A full moon is a negative 12.7. The brightest iridium flare is negative 8. Venus, the brightest planet in the sky, negative 4.4. Izzy, the International Space Station, raise your hand if you've ever seen that go overhead, negative 2. Sirius, the brightest star, negative 1.44. The limit of the human eye, plus 6 or plus 7. Mine's probably plus 4 or plus 5. Pluto is a plus 14. And the limit of the Hubble Space Telescope is a plus 30. So that said, if you hear parallax tonight, it's the way that we measure distances of an astronomical body from Earth. It's considered triangulation, similar to a land surveyor. And I spelled triangulation wrong there. This is how we measure the distance of the nearest stars. One of the big problems here in America, and you can see these maps and around the world, is light pollution. And it's killing astronomy because we come into this fatuation, and it originated in the early 1990s when gas prices went down, oil prices went down, of this lighting of 24/7, 365, and these huge automobile dealership mausoleums, which thankfully the lights are going out on. Astronomical observations for tonight. So here's what we're looking for, and we're in the home stretch here. Just after sunset, we're going to try to get Mercury, which will be just to the left of Pleiades as we look west-northwest. You'll see Aldebaran. Aldebaran is in what constellation?
Taurus.
Taurus, that's right. And look at the reason why I left Auriga up there is because we're going to be looking there if we can. So again, Mercury will be just next to the Pleiades. If you haven't seen Mercury, they say, or Native Americans said, it brings good luck. We could all use that, huh? Astronomical observations also. Now, this is just something. In Auriga, that constellation, the charioteer that I showed you above there, there's something called Epsilon Aurigae, which is it's about 5 o'clock from the brightest star in the constellation Capella. And this is a star that's a variable, and astronomers think that it's being obscured by some sort of bizarre dust cloud. It just so happens that there's an eclipse this summer beginning on August 11th, and where minimum light is December 19th, and it will continue through the March of 2011, so almost 2 years. And you can see the graph to the right of when this variable star goes much, much dimmer. Some other things, looking southwest, we're going to see, I guess we're going to call that a waning gibbous, everybody, moon tonight, looking southwest. And one of the great things about looking at the moon that I like, aside from all of the great craters named after all of the great astronomers and the great seas, is you can see where the Apollo landed. Up top, Archimedes, that's where Apollo 15 landed. Apollo 17 to about 330 from the right of that near the Mare Serenitatis. And then Apollo 11 in Sea of Tranquility. You can see Apollo 12, Apollo 14, but that's some of the fun stuff to look at when you look at the moon. And then, as I mentioned, the Eta Aquarii meteor shower peaks before dawn on May 6th. It will be originating from the constellation Aquarius. You'll see Jupiter if you're up that early. It's associated with Comet Halley. Tonight, when we look at Saturn, which is going to be up in the sky, you're going to get it looking at, I believe, gentlemen, the rings on, right? We're going to get a side view of it. Very little ring. And the magnitude is plus 0.8. I don't think that we're going to be able to see Neptune or Uranus. And again, here's where the moons are available. So to the right or to the west of Saturn, we'll see the moon Titan. To the east, we'll see Rhea. And I believe Tethys. Some other things, if we have any deep sky people here tonight, if they want to look at Ursa Major, a.k.a. the Big Dipper, and you can see M40, which is above Megrez, or M109, which is near Ficta. And M109 is basically a typical Messier object. It's a 2.4 magnitude. M40 isn't a galaxy. It's an unspectacular double star. There's some comets out. Comet Cardinal. Has anybody seen that from the group? Okay. It's a difficult get. It's a 9th magnitude, but that's the path of it. It's going to be very difficult to see. It's just north of M35. Another one, it's at 8.6 is Comet Cardinal, and that's where it sits. So it's not related to any bright star, and that's why it's a little more difficult to track. There's another one called Comet Yi Swan. Mag 8.5, which is hanging out just north of Perth.
Is it low?
Yep. Okay. Asteroids 7.8 series. I don't know if we're going to be able to get that because it's staying high above Leo. Another asteroid, this from this month's Sky Telescope, Irene, and the more dimmer Flora, which are basically moving about in Virgo. Irene is a magnitude 9. Again, a very difficult get for any astronomer here tonight. It was called, named by astronomer John Hind, who discovered this asteroid in 1851. The daughter of Zeus and Themis in Greek mythology was known as Irene, and it's the personification of peace. Again, there's the path of Irene and Flora. And then satellites. If we're here at 8:46, if we look 10 degrees to the south-southwest, and peak at 73 degrees in the east-southeast, and we're talking, this is a magnitude 2.6, at about 10 minutes of 9 tonight, just before we close up shop, you'll be able to see Genesis 1, and that's a rendering of what it looks like. And that's my talk, so thank you very, very much, everybody. I know it was an impromptu speech, but we hope to see you tonight. Any questions? Great, thank you very much.
If anyone's interested in coming back tonight, please. Operate and not be here. We'll be set up out back here.